Welcome to the LSE Events Podcast by the London School of Economics and Political Science. Get ready to hear from some of the most influential international figures in the social sciences.
Welcome, everyone. I'm Ken Benoit. I'm the director of the Data Science Institute and professor of computational social science. And I want to welcome you to this evening's event. We are very privileged to have Madhumita Murgia, who is going to talk about her new book, Codependent. And we are going to discuss this together through a series, having a conversation here, and you'll have a chance to ask questions as well. So let me tell you a little bit first about the Data Science Institute. So the Data Science Institute at LSE was created to integrate data science and the social sciences to offer the best opportunity. There may be a double feedback sort of thing happening. It's like one of those Zoom calls with the echo. Anyway, we wanted to create the Data Science Institute to offer the best opportunity to understand the sort of seismic changes that are taking place and to mitigate against harms and to unlock solutions to some of the world's most pressing problems like climate change, like political polarization and the challenges of health policy. This is why in 2020 we created the Data Science Institute at LSE to foster the study of data science and AI with a focus on the impact, on their impact on social, economic, and political considerations. That's what our talk tonight is an example of. This is one of the public events that we do at Data Science Institute, and I am going to introduce Madhu to you in a moment, but first I have a few operational things that we have to say at the beginning of every public event. So first of all, let me tell you that if you wish to use the platform formerly known as Twitter, you can use the hashtag LSEDSI. I would encourage you to tweet about the event, if that's what we still call it. I would also remind you that this event is being broadcast online via LSE Live and recorded, and hopefully a podcast will be available online subject to there being no technical difficulties. I would also remind you that, the running order for the proceedings, we're going to have a conversation, then we're going to have a Q&A, and after that we're going to have a book signing, and you'll have an opportunity to purchase the book and have that signed by Madhu, and if you wish to meet her. Also, I would have to inform you that there's a fire assembly point, and this is outside of Pankhurst House and Fawcett House, aka the Towers. If you exit and turn left and go down through the gate there, that's the fire assembly point, which hopefully we won't need to use. Okay, so let's get to the crux of the matter and the reason that we're all here tonight. Not because you're here to hear me talk about fire exits, it's to hear about Madhu's new book, Codependent. Madhumita Murgia is the first artificial intelligence editor of the Financial Times. She's been writing about AI for Wired and for the Financial Times for over a decade. She also features as a co-host on the podcast series Tectonic. Her new book, Codependent, Living in the Shadow of AI, which was what we'll be discussing this evening, is out tomorrow, although you can get advanced copies here this evening. And I am very pleased to say, and this is breaking news that we weren't allowed to announce before, this book has been long listed for the Women's Prize for Nonfiction.
Shortlisted now.
Shortlisted.
As of the last 10 minutes.
It was shortlisted today, long listed previously, thank you. What is the book about? Well, that's what we're here to listen to, not me, but Madhu, explain. Through the voices of ordinary people around the world, this book explores the impact of a set of powerful, flawed, and often exploitative technologies on individuals, on communities, and on wider society. I'm now going to invite you to tell us a little bit about the book and also what motivated you to write this book.
Sure. So, as you say, I've been writing about AI for 10 years, and it started with a journey to find out what data had been collected about me online and the profile that's built up about each of us through our interaction with the connected online world. So I went down this series of rabbit holes, this was while I was at my first job at Wired, to try and rebuild a profile of myself through all of the kind of data crumbs that had been left by me through my browsing on the internet, the things that I bought, the social media that I viewed, and came back with this startlingly accurate picture of who I was, but also what I believed and what I would become, my behaviors and my tendencies in the future. So this is kind of what spurred me to understand data and how it was being used to build businesses. And since then, I've chronicled the financial and other fortunes of some of the world's biggest companies, which are built on mounds of data that we leave behind and that are collected. With this book, and every story always has to have a beginning, and I think for me, that was Carl Rissanek. He was the thing that started this book for me. So he was, or he is, a facial recognition researcher. So he's a computer scientist, and he's one of the pioneers of computer vision technology. He built systems in the 80s for the US Navy to recognize objects, and this was used, for example, to navigate submarines. This was at a time when the technology was kind of much more primitive. You could barely kind of distinguish between, a glass and a face. And he would see kind of 1% improvements year on year. But over the years, as the technology got better and the data grew, you know, he was seeing huge jumps in the accuracy of computer vision technologies, 10% every year. And it got to a point, you know, in the 90s where it could recognize individual faces. And for him, that was, you know, magical evolution that he'd seen in his own career. But what was really interesting about Carl was that he'd always seen this as a sort of an academic tool, and he thought it could be used for good. So his technology, for instance, was used to identify a notorious gangster called Whitey Bulger, who had been hiding out in California for decades until his technology was able to identify him in a CCTV image. It's also helped to find missing children and so on. So he always kind of believed in the good of this technology. The other thing about Carl was that he's African-American, and he'd never really brought that side of him or that identity to his work. He never thought it was relevant to the fact that he was building computer vision algorithms. But in the course of his career, when the technology became so sophisticated that it was now used by police, by law enforcement around the world, he started to realize that those two parts of his identity were colliding. That the same technology that he had helped to build and bring into the world and create was now being actually turned against people like him, people from his own community, often who are over-policed, particularly in the United States, and misidentified, which is, you know, an inherent bias that exists in facial recognition, where it makes more errors when trying to identify women and people of color compared to Caucasian people or men. And, you know, he'd never thought that this technology would have any kind of real social impact, or he would have to think about the ethics of this, but suddenly he was forced to do it. And for the first time ever, a computer scientist told me that they experienced moral doubt about what they were doing, and they were worried about the impact of the code that they had helped to write. So for me, that was a moment of realization that this is not, you know, this technology isn't simply something that people code and put out into the world, but it has these real human implications, and that even a single individual within themselves are grappling with the kind of nuances and the black and white of this technology. So it kind of spurred me to find stories like Carl. So he's one of the people in my book, but I didn't just want to kind of look at creators of technology. I wanted to look at this through the perspective of people who have been impacted by it unexpectedly, people who have fought against it, people who are controlled by it, and through these stories of ordinary people to help us grapple with how our world is changing, how society is changing through increased automation and increasingly sophisticated technology built on top of our data. So that was the motivation for me. For the book, I traveled to 6 different countries and spoke to individuals ranging from a priest in the Vatican to a single mother in Amsterdam, a doctor in rural India, a bureaucrat in a tiny town in Argentina. And through their stories, was able to start to interrogate really what it's like to have automation start to replace things that we used to believe were human. I think for me, the book is really about 3 things. The first is people. It's about ordinary people in different walks of life and how they react, respond, and resist technology. And in many cases, these are people on the margins, invisible data workers, gig workers, migrants, refugees, and women who are unexpectedly harmed by these technologies as power is concentrated. The second thing that it's about is techno-solutionism, this idea that you can solve any problem in the world using technology. And this is the sort of idea that is really kind of popularized by Silicon Valley, by entrepreneurs in California who really believe they can solve, you know, world hunger and disease and climate change all through technology. And, you know, it's the optimism of that, but also how it falls down in reality again and again, which is what I saw in the stories that I reported when you try and implement them in, you know, without thinking it through. And the third thing that this book is about is agency of each of us as humans, that ability to make a difference to the world around us, to be able to change our own circumstances, and the illusion of having, or the reality, you know, of having free will and being able to make changes in our own circumstances. And for me, this book was looking at how AI has been changing already our individual agency and feeling of being able to control our own circumstances, but also how it's unexpectedly strengthened our collective agency as people start to group together and try to figure out how to shape this in a way that works for everybody. So I hope, you know, that a lot of the stories in this book are dark, are scary, but, you know, I focus also on the people who are using their own agency to kind of fight back and try and shape this future, a better future for everybody. So I hope that's the takeaway for those of you who, I hope, read my book.
Thanks. Thank you. Wow. 6 countries. I mean, that one of the things that impressed me most about your book, besides the very compelling way that you tell the stories and tie the narrative together, is the people that you've reached in these 6 countries, they are incredible, very human stories, and you really connect to them in a way that makes the reader understand their perspective and some of the challenges they face and why they reacted in the circumstances, why they have these stories. So let me ask, first of all, how did you find these fascinating people for the book?
That was the hardest bit, I think, because once I had, it's basically focused on maybe 10 people. And once I had those stories, you know, I maybe because I'm a journalist and I'm, you know, always curious, it was fascinating just to delve into each of those stories. So the hardest part was actually finding them. I think, so it was a mixture of things, but the for me, the main motivation was that I wanted this to be a global book. You know, I myself often am writing about technology from the perspective of the West, particularly Silicon Valley, the people building these technologies, the companies that, you know, sell them. And I wanted to step away from that because I felt that what I wasn't reading about was what was happening in India, in, you know, Africa, Latin America. So as I went deliberately searching in these parts of the world for, you know, how AI was being used and applied, it was actually not that hard because I was able to pinpoint. So in India, I look at a healthcare algorithm, for example. I went to the company that builds this system that helps to diagnose tuberculosis, and I asked them, are there any doctors using this? And ended up tracking down a doctor in a tiny village in Western India. Who spent hours with me kind of helping me understand the difference between human and AI doctors. Similarly, I was looking in Latin America for examples of AI in action, and found this really kind of compelling case of an AI system that was built by Microsoft used to predict teenage pregnancies. And there I managed to track down the bureaucrat who had implemented this in his town. And, you know, even though it wasn't the most glowing story about him, he welcomed me to his town and kind of really brought me into why he'd built this system and what ended up happening with it. So it was really a matter of looking in places that other people hadn't before, and being lucky enough that the people in the book opened up to me about sort of how AI had changed their perspective and their lives.
I'll mention something or give you a chance to explain something that we didn't talk about in your introduction, but you have a really interesting background in that you did a master's in journalism at NYU, but before that you were studying biology and immunology. What made you make the transition from those topics into journalism?
So I started out as a scientist, and I've always been interested in health and disease in particular, which is why I studied immunology and worked on HIV vaccine development. But for me, what I've loved is to break down complexity and kind of bring stories of science and now technology, of course, to the wider world. And practicing as a scientist, you know, you live in a bubble, you're at the cutting edge of the work, but it's very hard to also communicate. So for me, the joy of science was not so much in the doing of it, but in sharing it and kind of explaining it with people. So I decided to make the jump over from immunology into journalism and went to a program that was focused on science, health, and environmental reporting. I think the book is kind of full circle with that, because we're at a time now when AI is seen as so complex, it's so opaque, even to the people who build it, you know, we don't understand really what is happening inside generative AI systems to an extent. And for me, I think kind of the most fulfilling thing is being able to kind of break that down in some way to make it more transparent so that everybody who's going to be impacted by it, which is everybody in this room, can feel that they have a say and a place at the table and can engage with the topic rather than feel kind of locked out of the discussion or daunted by it. And that's kind of why I also wanted to tell the human stories, which I would have never got to do as a scientist. So, yeah.
That's fascinating. Yeah, you're right that AI is like a black box, even to some of the researchers that have built the systems that process the vast amounts of data. And as you show refer to in some of the passages, some of the stories from your book, some of the corporations and what happens behind them and internally, they have as much secrecy and as security as some governments might. So what happens inside those is like a black box. The Guardian article that reviewed your book that was published on Saturday starts with a question, what's in the box? Kind of a reference to a David Fincher film, but also a very apt question for the what is in the box, what's in the black box. Let me touch on some of the stories that you referred to that are from the book and some of the concepts, some of the themes that you use to illustrate them. And I would mention, by the way, it's one of the things that struck me most about the book that made it unlike any book about AI and the issues that we talk about in many guises, that made it really, really different, really refreshingly new from an angle that I had not read before, were the human stories that you tell. I mean, you illustrate the major sections of the book through these big themes, but they're told through very personal stories. So the impact that they would have at the end of a supply chain that might otherwise be a very remote or abstract process is humanized in a very direct way through the detailed stories that you tell about the people confronting the issues and their backgrounds and their histories and the choices they confront and having interviewed them. So let me ask you about, so let's take one of the issues. So you talk a lot about the algorithms that have literally spread to the sort of decisions that make the difference between life or death or freedom or incarceration. they, as you say, affect everyone's life and many parts of those lives. I was really struck by the story that you talked about just earlier, when you talked about the, you referred to the woman that was in the village in Western India, Ashita, and she was using a product from a company called Cure, I think I pronounced that right, Cure.ai, and they had a diagnostic system for tuberculosis. Later it was used, well, later it was finding predictions that were confusing tuberculosis predictions with diagnosis of COVID-19, because that was a something new. You also recall how she had faced a malaria epidemic in 2006 when 300 people from her small village died, which is a very, very, very significant number given the small size of this, and how that tortured her at night, because she realized every day she had to make diagnostic decisions that could mean life or death, depending on whether what course of treatment she had to take decisions for. In other words, agency, this theme that you mentioned about agency. And I'll quote a passage from your book, if I may. You wrote, and you're referring to Ashita here, "She has never allowed technology, including AI, to usurp her agency as a physician. AI is designed to provide an answer in black or white. It lacks nuance. But, Ashita said, I'm making nuanced decisions, moral choices as a doctor. AI can't do that." So this is part of the relationship we have with technology, and maybe part of the illustration or part of why you chose this title, this clever play on words, code-dependent or codependent. We have this unhealthy dependent relationship with technology, which in this case could produce a problem where if doctors find diagnostic tools to help them, AI tools to help them diagnose diseases that they might have missed otherwise as humans, eventually they could become reliant on those. And there are also systems where the economic pressures to process more and more patients could lead to a forced reliance on AI tools, or just downstream, some doctors losing the ability to make those diagnoses on their own. And that reliance, that codependency, could cause doctors to lose some of their agency as physicians. So, I don't know, that was a compelling theme, and thought maybe you could talk more about this problem of this loss of agency that we could face as a result of AI, either willingly or unwillingly.
Yeah, so that came up again and again, because many of the places in which we're seeing AI already playing a role are places where we used to rely on human expertise. So medicine is a very clear example. We obviously rely on human doctors to train for many years, and then we kind of trust them to use the tools to then decide, you know, to diagnose us and then decide how to treat us. And we have, it's more than just kind of a transactional relationship with a doctor of tell me what's wrong with me and tell me what to do. You know, it's a very vulnerable human relationship. You know, this is why the bedside manner matters so much, how somebody breaks the news to you. So that what I kind of learned from spending time with Ashita was how it's such a human, you know, nuanced, it's not even a science. She calls medicine an art, which I thought was really fascinating, because you can have all of the knowledge and still be a bad doctor. You can, you know, not trust your patients. You can kind of stick to your guns and not hear what they're saying. So you need to be able to listen and kind of empathize and have all of these very human qualities. AI, on the other hand, you know, it has very specific strengths where it is able to read, you know, millions, hundreds of thousands of scans, x-rays, CT scans, scan this data and pull out patterns. And it can scale up what, you know, one very good doctor might be able to do. You can basically scale that up to hundreds of locations. You can take it to areas where you don't have you know, any care at all. You know, you can bridge, you know, gaps in healthcare in parts of the world and even parts of the country where people are struggling to access care. So it's a wonderful tool in that way. But you know, but it has its own flaws. And in the question of agency, I think that the fear is that as new doctors start to qualify, they just start to become over-reliant on these tools because they no longer need to know how to read a scan because you already have an AI tool that does that. So with Dr. Singh, with Ashita, you know, she knew, she was confident in her own experience and her abilities that she'd developed over years of doing this. She'd seen every type of tuberculosis walk in through her clinic doors, and so she could kind of, she almost helped train the algorithmic system. So she wasn't concerned necessarily about the agency of people like herself or doctors like herself, but she did worry about her students and the new generation of doctors. And we see this in, you know, constantly when it comes to automation, right, with, you know, pilots or, you know, cars, that the more complex and opaque these technological systems become, the harder it is for us to kind of, you know, break them apart and take control because we don't know how they work any longer. So I think that a big part of kind of how we solve forward, going forward, how, you know, what an AI future looks like is by figuring out how do we preserve the power of human expertise and experience. How can we introduce an AI system but make sure that there is a way to check it, to audit the outcomes, and to make sure that humans who've gained experience, lived experience, or learned experience kind of retain that power and expertise so that if and when things do go wrong, as they're likely to, because these systems are fallible, you know, they're not, they're far from perfect. You know, there's inherent biases, and there are statistical. You know, you kind of teach data science. You're never going to get the correct answer every single time when it's purely a statistical system. So when they do go wrong, there has to be somebody who kind of says, "I can step in and I can tell you that that's wrong." And the way that AI is being implemented today, whether that's in criminal justice, in government services, you know, I show examples of these. That doesn't exist. We're not retaining human agency. Often we're just sort of replacing, you know, with social workers or, you know, police and saying, just use the system instead. And so we're going to start to lose that institutional expertise. That's that, and that's, you know, that's not a fault of the technology necessarily or the people building it, but that's really kind of the work that governments and the people implementing these systems that we all should be kind of thinking about as this increasingly becomes embedded into our society.
Let's explore this notion of how do we know when things go wrong and I'm interested in what tools that we could say the public, but also we as experts, what do we have to counter, for example, biases built into algorithms? And I'll point to the convincing story you tell about Zayed in Boston. And he was the physician, I believe he was a physician.
Yeah, he's an emergency room physician.
Exactly, yeah. And he realized that the AI system that was designed by the company called Optum, which is a large American healthcare company that I think was responsible for 70 million patients per year, approximately in the United States, had a system that was systematically discriminating against patients with black patients with darker skin.
That is true. And it was obviously done accidentally. And this was because of actually how the system was designed. This was an algorithm that was supposed to look at chronically ill patients and decide who should get additional support and care so that their symptoms could be managed better and they wouldn't kind of progress and get worse. And they found that it was systematically discriminating against black people and that they were not meeting the threshold to get additional care, even though they were sicker in many cases than their white counterparts. And the reason for that is the way it was calculated was based on healthcare costs. So how much do people cost the healthcare system? And they were using that as a proxy for how much they needed the care. But actually what Ziad Obermeier discovered was that, you know, costs and need are not necessarily the same thing. Often people who are, you know, in this case, African Americans or other marginalized communities, they can't access care because either they can't afford it, they can't get, you know, time out of work, they're vulnerable or precarious, or they just, you know, they face kind of societal discrimination in the system, which discourages them from even going and kind of taking advantage of medical care. So for a variety of social reasons, actually their costs were lower than what their needs were, and therefore the system was kind of seeing them as healthier than it should have. And, you know, so I think that there are kind of widespread biases in AI systems. This is accepted, this is known. I talked about facial recognition. We don't know why yet, even experts don't, but they do struggle to identify female and darker skinned faces compared to, you know, their male or white counterparts. Similarly, you know, we've seen biases in healthcare systems, we've seen biases in policing systems where they kind of over-police certain minorities because of how often they come into contact with the police, that it turns into a self-fulfilling cycle. So these do come up again and again, and I think it's very difficult as an average person to know, you know, how bias is built into a, you know, a layered AI system and how to stop it or how to know when things are going wrong. And that shouldn't be our responsibility. You know, when you're subject to a hiring algorithm, when you're trying to get a job, it's not your problem to make sure that the system is not discriminating against you, right? That is definitely the responsibility of the companies that are implementing it and the companies building it. And I think the kind of primary way for us to trust these systems more, but also to kind of hold them to account, is that there's some understanding of what these outputs are. And there's a lot of technical work being done in this space, so in particular evaluation, so third-party evaluating of AI systems, which is, it's really at the cutting edge because nobody seems to be able to agree. You know, I've spoken to companies like OpenAI, Anthropic, Google, Microsoft, there isn't really kind of widespread agreement on how to do third-party auditing of an AI system. And that's something that's kind of being figured out in real time as these systems are being implemented already in our society. So the first thing to do is for the technologists to kind of work on that question of how do we get outsiders to be able to check what's happening. And then the second part of it, which to kind of improve trust of us and for us, is that there's a kind of, there are regulations to ensure that if you are using a system to, you know, give somebody a job or admit them into a university or decide if they should get insurance or whether they're eligible for benefits, you know, things that are really life-changing, that you do have a human alternative to the algorithm. And this is kind of part of some of our current regulation, like with GDPR, data protection, you have the right to ask for human review if you're not sure that the algorithm is giving you the right answer. But this has to be enforced as the systems become much more consequential in our lives. We can already see AI kind of exploding around us in work and in so many other aspects, and we need to know through regulation that there is somebody who is providing, there's an appeal system and an alternative. And actually, I'll just share a story. This is not in my book, but I've reported on it since for the FT. For me, the most consequential example of this was a case of organ transplantation. So I met a family. There was a young woman who was on the list for a liver transplant. And her sister happened to be a data scientist by complete coincidence. And she's had chronic illnesses her whole life, which is why she needed a liver transplant at, you know, 30. But her sister began to look into the transplantation system in the UK. You know, how likely is her younger sister to be able to get a liver, and kind of when would she get it? And she figured out that in the UK, for kind of the majority of livers that you can get, there is an algorithmic system that decides who goes to the top of the list. It's purely decided by the system. There's no human intervention. All you really get to do as a human, a doctor, is you get offered a liver, and then you can decide if you want it for your patient or not. And then the system decides who the next person is. So there's no sort of human intervention. And as she managed to get a hold through kind of FOIs and writing to NHS Blood and Transplant, get hold of the actual statistical system behind the algorithm. And she discovered that and this has kind of been supported by some of the research being done around the system and how it's working, that it was penalizing younger people. So it was systematically, if you were under 40, you were pretty much it was almost impossible that you were ever going to get a liver through the system. And there is a second method to get a liver, which is non-algorithmic, but it's for a type of liver which, without getting into the details, is kind of less likely for better survival rates. And there are fewer of those types of livers. So for the kind of majority of livers in the UK, you're going through this algorithmic system. And the reason for that, again, was that, you know, the system was trying to reduce mortality on the waiting list. So how could we have as few deaths as possible on the waiting list? And to do that, it was giving preference to older people because they were more likely to die while being on the waiting list. But it meant that they were systematically discriminating against younger people. And so, you know, these are the types of decisions that when you're faced with, you know, you really just want a bunch of human experts to come in and be like, yeah, this is wrong, and, you know, she is going to die on this list, and we should find an alternative way that gets around this algorithm. You know, you want a human voice in there, which they spent, you know, months fighting NHSBT on this and never got anywhere. So that's just a kind of very consequential example of what happens if we don't have, you know, human alternatives.
We talked about the black boxes before and how peering inside may not even be possible. And one of the, and it may not be possible for experts or for individuals. And that this sounds like the algorithm for the organ transplants was sufficiently transparent that it could be analyzed for that. This notion of control, of trying to hold algorithms accountable, it could be extremely difficult for many people. And that was one of the things I think you, in the story in the book about Pablo, who was in the city of Salta in northwest Argentina. It's a city where I think 40% of the population is below the poverty line, and a quarter of babies are born to teenage mothers. And this was a story about how they had enlisted the local governor, and he, as a bureaucrat and as a technologist, had enlisted Microsoft to do a study to try to figure out an algorithm that would help detect the causes for this and then implement policies or suggest policies that might reduce it. Through predicting the individuals that were likely to, I think, become pregnant. But they gathered a lot of data, and then the political governors changed, and then it wasn't implemented. But one of the things that Pablo said, I think you reported, he said, well, people, if we tried to explain the algorithms, he had a system, a rival system. He said, if we tried to explain it, people wouldn't understand it anyway. Right? And that's possibly it's a pessimistic statement, but it's probably in many cases true. When we talk about things like the machinery of the sort of deep learning models, of the architectures that are used for these very deep artificial neural networks today, it's not even possible for researchers necessarily to understand their operation. I deal a lot with natural language processing, for instance, and large language models and their operations. And I have been to presentations with people from OpenAI, for example, and one thing that you can't get them to talk about is something that you do mention in your book, the company called Sama. They do content moderation, and that's the big thing that they have to do, content moderation for companies like OpenAI, you mentioned, and Meta or Facebook. Accountability comes from having your basically alienating your customer base. And if your product starts becoming a Nazi chatbot, as happened when Microsoft tried something on Twitter a couple years ago, or if it goes a little bit crazy like ChatGPT did about a month ago, I think it basically just started producing nonsense for an afternoon and then they fixed it. So if we wanted to, accountability could just be a question of not harming your product and your bottom line and your customers. But that's a little bit depressing because the pathologies of that sort of capitalist model might lead you to cause harms to marginalized populations or people who aren't your constituents or your primary market, people further down in the supply chain. That's, I guess that's part of the story that you're telling when it comes to this notion of accountability, and the story being that the people who, for example, in the story of Daniel from Kenya, who worked at this company called Sama, who was suing Meta for unfair dismissal because of the conditions as a content moderator, and that he had been asked to sift through and label images that were so disturbing that it said that after 1 year of working under conditions for £1 an hour or £1.80 per hour with very few breaks, he had to witness images of human sacrifice, of beheadings, of child abuse, basically for content moderation, because those are the guardrails necessary to deliver that product in a saleable way to their main customers.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of hidden labor in AI in particular, and that's something that I was surprised at how invisible that was to most people. You think of the technology as being automated because it's supposed to be intelligent, it's supposed to replace us and come for us, and so you assume that it's self-learning, right? But it absolutely isn't. At the moment, even the most sophisticated language models, chatbots, ChatGPT, they learn from labeled examples, really, largely. And to do that, you need some person or hundreds and thousands of people to label that, whether that's snippets of text, images, videos. People are labeling objects in videos, spending 8-9 hours a day labeling single hours of driving videos to help us have self-driving ability in our Teslas, for example. So for me, the fact that this entire workforce existed and nobody really knew where they were, how they were involved, and not even they were aware in many cases of where they fit into the supply chain here. So I traveled to Kenya, to Bulgaria, and to Buenos Aires to meet with workers, and their jobs are, they're data labelers or data laborers, as I kind of called them. And, it wasn't necessarily that there were terrible conditions. I think the content moderation Ken talks about is different. It's very traumatic because that's kind of labeling the worst of the internet, and I think that's a separate kind of issue. But for regular data labeling, it's scenes of driving down a road, or it might be buildings, or kind of geospatial kind of images of fields. It depends what the output is, right, that they're trying to teach an algorithm to recognize and to learn. But so it wasn't necessarily kind of bad working environment, but in so many cases, there was so much lack of awareness of how they fit into what's turning into a $1 trillion industry. We see reports constantly from the likes of McKinsey, BCG, Goldman Sachs about the sort of upside of this technology, right? It's going to supercharge our productivity. It's going to, it's going to inject all this money into our global economy. It's trillions of dollars going to come out the other end. And yet on this end, you have many of the people that I spoke to were living in slums, in informal settlements, who were, earning a living wage for where they lived. And it helped to pull them out of poverty in many cases, as any job will, right? It was helping them to send their children to school, to kind of not, have to work in manual labor and so on. But in no way were they seeing any of the upside of the kind of AI revolution that the rest of us are hearing about and reading about, and which the companies that employ these people are already seeing or benefiting from. Many of the clients that the data laborers had, which they often didn't know who they were, are companies that are now $1 trillion companies, right? From Google to Meta to OpenAI, it's not a $1 trillion company, but it's funded by, partnered with Microsoft, which is. And so there was this real kind of imbalance of power, a real concentration, an entrenchment of power amongst a really small group of companies in this one corner of the world, and this huge kind of impact far flung from, as I said, all over the world, Southeast Asia to Africa, people who didn't even know what they were building or how the world was going to be using it, and who weren't benefiting from the upsides. And so, I, f- it was really fascinating to see this evolving in real time. And I think one of the big projects for us as a society over the next few years is to figure out how we value that kind of work, you know, how we fit data labeling and content moderation into the overall development of AI, into the pipeline, and, you know, how they can benefit from this revolution in the way that, you know, the rest of us are hoping to as well.
Hi, I'm interrupting this event to tell you about another awesome LSE podcast that we think you'd enjoy. LSE IQ asks social scientists and other experts to answer one intelligent question, like, why do people believe in conspiracy theories? Or, can we afford the super rich? Come check us out. Just search for LSE IQ wherever you get your podcasts. Now, back to the event.
So, yeah.
What do you think the solution would be? Will we one day have the ethical equivalent for AI of coffee, where we have fair trade AI that certifies that the supply chain of the AI provenance was ethically sourced?
I mean, yeah, I think the first thing is transparency, right? Because if we don't even know that there's like thousands of people doing this job in a factory in the Philippines or in Kenya, then we don't even think about how, you know, we don't consider them. When by we, I mean sort of economists or the companies themselves. But the more transparency we have about how AI is trained, who does the training, what are they earning, what are their working conditions, I think the more they can kind of become part of the conversation that and can participate in figuring out what they should be paid and what you know their working lives should look like. So transparency, I think, is the first thing. But yeah, maybe we do, you know, we do need rules and regulations around how people are treated, what they're paid, and we can maybe escape some of the pitfalls of sort of previous outsourcing that we've seen when it comes to kind of fashion, clothing, IT, and other sectors.
So is that the role of an AI journalist? Is that what? Because it's a fairly unusual role that you have at the FT. I think you're the only AI journalist at a major newspaper or any newspaper that I know of that has that title. So is that your role is to provide some of that transparency?
Yeah. So I definitely don't see myself as an activist in any way, and my role as a reporter journalist is to bring to light things that either companies don't want us to or that are other people aren't paying attention to. But there's also the explanatory role of saying, here's what this technology is, here's how it works, here's, you know, the impact that it's having, so that people can figure out kind of how to apply it in their own worlds. And so I think there's explanation, transparency. I see my role also as centering this on, you know, not to keep it very abstract. I do, of course, I work for the Financial Times. We write about businesses, you know, we write about the economy. but, you know, all of that stuff is made up of people. And I think that this technology is so kind of embedded in our behavior, and it's changing everything from, you know, work to creativity, how you know, what we make for art and what we write. So I really think that we all need to kind of be involved in this story, and it can't just be like a finance story or an economic story.
Considering the breadth and the depth of the issues that are covered throughout your book, what would you say is the most important takeaway for readers of Code Dependent, and why?
That's a hard one. I feel like as a writer, you put something out into the world, and then every reader has their own, you know, interpretation, their own perspective, and that's kind of the joy of writing something and then having so many different people read it. So I don't necessarily have one thing that I want everyone to kind of believe when they read my book, but I do want to reach people who didn't think that they were interested in technology or in AI. And I come to this with a decade of experience of having written about the technology itself, the businesses, and so on. So I'm not I don't want to oversimplify it in any way, but I want people to come to this book thinking this is something that we should all care about and that we can all have a voice and an opinion about. Just like we have now with the internet, you know, we don't see it as sort of some separate thing, and, you know, nobody now today really, you know, under a certain age really says, oh, but I'm not interested in the internet, right? It's just, it's completely embedded in how we interact and how we behave in our personal and professional lives, and this is what AI is starting to become. And I think we did, as a collective, sleepwalk a little bit into the social media kind of revolution, and we're now in a position where we're sort of, you know, at the altar of these algorithms and kind of can't stop scrolling, particularly young people. And I think that we are now kind of experiencing another huge shift in how we will interact with one another. And we should all, you know, we all have our own expertise and our own voices that we can bring to this. And that's kind of what I hope the book, you people take away from it, that they can have a say and they can have a view on AI as it kind of sweeps all our lives.
I think that's a great point on which to open up questions to members of the audience, because I'm sure that they have a voice and something to say about these topics, and we have a good amount of time for the questions. So we're going to take some questions, a mixture of questions from the audience here, and we also will have some online questions. So if you're online and watching this and you're live, you can put your questions and they'll be filtered to me and show up here. So why don't we start here in the front row? We'll start with you, sir. And you will need, I encourage you to mention, you introduce yourself briefly if you'd like.
Thank you very much for the presentation. My name is Alexander. I work in the health tech, so we do implement a lot of different AIs. And I have a question about the famous trolley problem. When it originated 50 years ago, it was a thought experiment. And yet, as we speak, someone else is training the ML model, and someone has to decide, right? Or train the model, then it would decide how to behave in this situation. I wonder what's your perspective on either the approach or the regulation or the transparency of this kind of thing.
Yeah. So you're talking about the trolley problem, which is, you know, that the decision, say, in with a car of if it had to kill somebody, should it be the old person or the child,
or
right?
One or five people, et cetera, et cetera.
Exactly, or should you kill an entire load? Yeah, exactly. How do you choose who to kind of help and who to harm? This is really key now to kind of almost every AI system that we're seeing, kind of implemented in so many different areas. And it's really interesting. So I'll take criminal justice as an example. So I do have a chapter in my book looking at a predictive system in Amsterdam that the mayor's office put out, which basically was trying to predict which children would go on to commit a serious crime. And it basically put them on a list and scored them as being the top 400 most likely children who are going to go on to be criminals. And the goal was, to bring in social services and to kind of help them. It's really interesting because I spoke to a criminologist about kind of how do you make decisions about who you decide, you know, who's going to be a criminal, who should get bail. And he said that these are not statistical questions. I build a lot of these systems for kind of, in the US, a lot of courts and states around the US use his systems for bail, for example. And he says, I can never kind of code that in, because these are human questions. And so he says the only way that you can figure out who should kind of be forgiven, who should get on a list, is to put all the experts in a room and get them to fight it out, you know, to decide kind of what are the trade-offs, what are you willing to sacrifice, and when you get consensus with a group of experts, then you can start to code it in. And I think that feels to me like the most sensible way, right? Like, rather than trying to hard code, you know, in an organ transplant system, oh, younger people can wait longer, so let's just give all the livers to people over 40, instead, you want to have a much more nuanced kind of, and that you only get from kind of humans, right? People with different backgrounds, different expertise, to come together and decide what the trade-offs are. So, you know, it's a hard question, because as we start to defer to the systems, it starts to become more black or white, and that's how you get sort of computer says no, where there's no agency, right? But, I think it has to be done through consensus and through human discussion.
I can see we have a lot of questions. I've got a list. We're going to favor the students at the front of the class a little bit. Gentleman over here on the end, and then we're going to get, I've got you marked, and I've got some online as well.
Cheers. It's a fascinating, I'm David Walter, I'm a researcher, I got my degree at Birkbeck, History and International Relations. When I did my research on, you know, on things like AI, I realized that AI has its foundation in the rise of the machines in the 19th century, and those weaponizations of the machine also gave rise to the Luddite movement. I also realized that the technology that brought about AI was never going to be guaranteed. So for instance, after Babbage's invention of the deference engine, there was like 100 years where the interest in computers, in any kind of computer systems, was not very important to the scientists and engineers until the Second World War. How do you know? I mean, it's a very utopian view you have of AI. How do you know that it's not just part of a dystopian history that has been around since the late 18th century?
Yeah, I think if you read my book, maybe you wouldn't still think I have a utopian view of AI. I think the reading of it has been that it is very dark. And I think I see it, I see my view as more realistic. And if you look at how AI is impacting people in the world around us, I see a lot more harm than good. So I don't have a utopian view of it at all. But I'm naturally an optimist, and my early years of journalism, I worked at a magazine which was all about celebrating innovation and techno-solutionism, entrepreneurs, and kind of fixing, you know, incumbents and disrupting the kind of the big guy. And so I do still hold some of that optimism. And so I hope still that the technology and the power that it has can be used to solve some of, kind of, like healthcare for me is kind of the most important problem that I think it could solve. Science too, as a way to kind of increase our knowledge and understanding of the world. But I think if we don't change how this is implemented, it is, as you say, going to multiply all of the historic inequities that we've seen before with the Industrial Revolution and so on. But there's way more power and money at stake, way more concentration of power amongst a very small group of engineers and computer scientists, so the outcomes could be much worse. So for me, it's not so much about saying this is the dystopia that's coming, but to be very real, which I think is kind of my role as a journalist too, to say this is what's happening, here is the reality, and what are we going to do about it? So, yeah.
We got so many questions. There's a question for this gentleman back here on the right.
Hello there. I'm a former law enforcement intelligence analyst. Over 20 years ago, I used to teach in training courses the John F. Kennedy case, partly because we got free software for it, so it didn't cost us anything. And even then, I noticed a disturbing tendency for people to rely on what we'd now call data in a system rather than asking questions first. My question is, who is reacting and noting your book, and who is ignoring it?
That's a tough one. Yeah, well, it's not been out very long, so you know, I'd be curious to see who does read it. I was heartened to see that Microsoft has invited me to speak to their office in Brussels. And, you know, they are in the book, and it's not necessarily the kind of in the best light. And I am actually really heartened by that, because you often tend to see when you interact with big tech companies that they can be very defensive. And I had been asked by others before inviting me, are we in your book? And kind of, can we see what is said about us before we do, which Microsoft didn't. They've kind of have had me come in, and they've been very open with me when I went to them during the reporting of the book. So I do think that, like, that we will see if the companies do engage with this, with the kind of questions of power and what I kind of call data colonialism in the book, because it's important that, you know, they're a part of the story whether I write them in or not, maybe the one of the most important bits. So yeah, thank you for that question. There's a woman there.
Thank you very much. So my name is Tiziana. I'm an alumni of the LSE. I work in for a data provider. And I'd actually like to bring the human back into the question. So AI is a field which is dominated by men and white men. And I want to ask you how it is for you to be a woman in this field, and what, share a little bit on your experience. I feel like in my field, I need to work harder if I want to convince people. And a lot of the people I need to convince, the decision makers, are men. And I always need to prepare better and do better. And I want to ask you how this has been for you, and maybe also what the field is losing by excluding women or being less accessible to women. Thank you.
Thank you. I think one of the motivations for me to write the book was to include, to bring in readers, as I said, who don't traditionally think that they have an interest in technology or in AI. And it's not that I specifically use this method of reporting on people in order to reach women, but I think that's naturally, that's who I am. And stories kind of, they touch, you know, wider groups of people. And it was a motivation for me to bring in female and other voices and readers to engage with this topic, because, as you say, often the people that I go to for comment or who I go to for their expertise, you know, inherently, just because of how the field is very male-dominated, tend to be men. So that's kind of, for me, it's my daily job is also, you know, and this is something we do at the FT more broadly, think about who are we going to for comment, for analysis, for expertise. And, you know, we often just tend to kind of default to the same people we've done before, or to the most kind of visible people, which often tend to be male experts. So I think part of what I try and do, and what we're trying to do more widely in our newsroom, is to take the time to find the expertise that isn't just the obvious one. And there are many female experts in AI, both kind of machine learning, you know, scientists, but also those who work on, you know, ethics and the social aspects of it, but also people building these products, you know, and it's about, like, finding those voices. And I think in terms of the industry itself, yes, very, very male-dominated. And I think it will be really interesting to see how that lack of diversity reflects in the product itself, because AI is really a reflection, not just of partly the data that it's trained on, but also of so many decisions baked into the systems of what, you know, we talked about the trolley problem, like the ethics baked into it. Who should it be, who should benefit from this? Who's going to be harmed? And these are all human ethical kind of decisions that are reflected in the system. And if we want something that reflects all of us, then you need to have engineers, ethicists, you know, of all genders and from around the world, to kind of build a more, not just inclusive system, but a system that's reflective of all of us, if it's going to be used by us all, right? So I think that that's kind of really important for the development of AI.
I'm going to take one of the questions from our online participants, because it's a bit of a follow-up on this question. This is from Professor Sonia Livingstone, who's a professor in the LSE Media and Communications Department. She asks if we might be placing too much faith in human decision-making, and the idea that if we got experts in the room and had them give an opinion even on an algorithm or AI, or whether even before the advent of AI, are humans and experts really so unbiased? Are they not also the products of class, gender, and the biases that have been part of society for so long?
Yeah, so I hear that a lot, and I get it, and you know I see why you know people bring that up. Of course, humans are biased, like, and bias is not even necessarily a bad thing. It's just how every person brings their own lived perspective to the table, right? That we're all inherently biased because of all of the things that shaped us, that bring us into this room, that like affect every decision we make. So, and of course, there's systemic racism, there's sexism. We know that human beings relate better to people who look like them. You know, when you have hiring systems, we know that people kind of feel more of a connection to somebody they have something in common with. And so, yes, there is bias amongst humans. But kind of my take on that is, because we're all human, we all start from the same position of understanding. We know where we stand. We kind of understand what those biases are, and which helps us to legislate against them and so on. What with AI systems, those biases are not the same as human ones. They're like unexpected, and also in many cases kind of, you know, they don't necessarily make sense to us as humans. They're statistical biases that come from patterns drawn out of huge data sets. So sometimes the kind of biased responses that we see out of AI systems, we wouldn't even necessarily know to expect as humans. And the other issue is that they get scaled up so much more quickly than human bias, right? You can have a biased judge or a biased employer, but they aren't, you know, their views aren't being integrated into a system that affects millions of people. But with an AI system that you can roll out at scale and speed, you're kind of multiplying that at a scale that's very different to humans. So I think it's not necessarily like, oh, humans are biased and therefore AI is better. I think it's a different set of issues that we have to kind of perceive differently.
Thank you. We had a question back here. We could, this gentleman with his hand up on the left, so I would take a question from this section.
Thank you. Martin Thompson, former generalist journalist. We talked at the beginning about facial recognition systems. To me, and perhaps to you and others, this is one of the more dystopian, you might say, post-Orwellian aspects of AI implementation. I have heard of projects within Chinese cities where AI-generated facial recognition systems are used to create a system of social credit, whereby your facial expressions are actually monitored, and you know, if you are seen to be, you know, in giving the wrong kind of message through your facial expressions, this will count against you. And conversely, you know, if you're looking happy at your desk, working away, you will be given actually benefits, you know, physical, tangible benefits. I mean, I'd be very interested in you to hear more about your thoughts on that.
Yeah, there was a really interesting piece actually today in Rest of the World, which is a great online publication that reports on technology from outside of the West, which I would highly recommend. But it was about sort of how facial recognition is changing the nature of protest around the world. And this is something that I talk about in my chapter, which kind of focuses on Carl and his moral dilemmas, but looks more broadly at how facial recognition has spread. And it's not just in China. I think China is one very dystopian example of how you can, if you kind of connect up all the dots, you can track people and catch them in a dragnet of surveillance. And you are seeing that particularly in Xinjiang, with the Chinese authorities trying to kind of focus on the Uyghur Muslim population in particular. But it's not just there. You know, here in the UK, facial recognition is now being used by the Met Police across London, across other parts of the country as well. You know, they have a watch list of people, and they kind of roll out these vans now every so often in Oxford Street and Notting Hill and so on, where they're searching for people, scanning everybody's faces in the public. It's been used during protests. It's been used during Notting Hill Carnival. You know, this is true in the US now, in India, in Hong Kong during the protests, facial recognition was used on people. So yeah, I spent actually almost a full year, I don't know how the FT allowed me to do that, but just mostly writing about facial recognition in 2019. Because I just found it so fascinating how we were kind of sleepwalking into like a sort of global reality where this was just being becoming par for the course. And it's not just governments as well. So here in the UK, I met with the owner of Gordon's Wine Bar, which is the famous bar in the Embankment, not far from here. And he told me that he'd started a facial recognition company because he'd had lots of pickpockets in his bar, and he'd been really embarrassed in front of some friends because the friend had been pickpocketed in his own bar. And so he put up these cameras and started developing technology to essentially catch pickpockets in Gordon's Wine Bar. And you know, there are examples. King's Cross, for example, is owned by Argent, which is a sort of private landlord for the whole area. They had cameras out just in public around King's Cross, which was a story I broke, scanning faces of people. So there's a real blurring between the public and private sector as well, with this under the guise of security or convenience, but regulation hasn't caught up with it because there are lots of kind of exceptions. And it definitely changes the nature of sort of believing that you're anonymous in a crowd when you walk outside. You kind of walk around knowing that nobody knows who you are. Therefore, you can be part of a protest or whatever it is. But now that no longer holds true. And that worries me is what that means for us as we kind of inhabit public life.
I'm going to take a question from our online audience, and then we're going to get to some more here in the live audience. So this is a question from Garima Chowdhury, who was worked with us last term in one of our courses teaching data science at the Data Science Institute, and she's interested in your experiences working as a journalist and your work around AI. And she asks, what would be the definition of success for you as a journalist in the world of AI?
It's interesting because now with generative AI, you know, you can see that it's able to do a lot of the things that supposedly journalists do, right? Which is summarize information, write stories, headlines, and it is hard to kind of avoid the question of can it replace journalists? I haven't been too worried about it so far. I think that's very human, right? We have the hubris that allows us to go around thinking everything's going to be fine. But I do think that there is a difference between what human journalists do and what AI could. And I think success for me as a person and not a machine is being able to, you know, and I think I said this previously, bringing stories to light that people would otherwise prefer not to. And I don't think that AI can yet do that. You know, it can make sense of information, it can explain, it can break down. But I think like going out, connecting the dots, and kind of, you know, investigating into areas where you meet huge resistance, that is the true power and value of kind of good human journalism.
I really like that answer. Let's see. How about you here, the woman with red hair there?
Hi. I'm not in this field or sector at all. I work for the Refugee Council. but thank you so much. That was so interesting. And I was just wondering about your point about data colonialism. We talk so much, I guess, at the moment about the declining influence of the US in sort of global politics. But obviously you focus so much on how so much sort of the AI world is concentrated in Silicon Valley in the US, and when it comes to these big supply chains, a lot of the people at the bottom of those supply chains are in places like India, Africa, and so on, even when it comes to data labeling, this kind of thing. And I was just wondering how much you felt, therefore, that with so much of that AI, those AI companies, power, money, influence coming out of the States affects America's global standing. I guess that's quite a big question.
Yeah.
But just wondering, yeah, from a sort of leveling up perspective, whether we're also seeing other big pockets of power when it comes to AI emerging elsewhere as well to rival that sort of Silicon Valley pole positioning, if you like.
Yeah, no, that's really interesting. I mean, one of the things that came out for me through the book was that in many cases, the companies are more powerful than governments. Partly it's, you know, the data that they hold, the infrastructure that they control, and obviously money as well. I spoke to a Mexican data analyst or ethicist called Paula Ricarte, and she said during the pandemic, you know, Mexico couldn't even do its own sort of COVID-19 messaging without the help of Google. They needed Google to kind of figure out how it was spreading and kind of how they were going to counter that, because they were dependent on the sort of infrastructure provided by Google. This came up again in India, you know, where much of the government's infrastructure is based on Amazon Web Services and kind of Microsoft Azure. So increasingly, these companies are becoming state-like in the reliance that governments have on them, but also, you know, in terms of like their direct access to citizens and to people around the world, and how they can directly influence us through the products that they sell us and that we use. So that's kind of one aspect of it, where it's less about sort of how it reflects on the American government, but more they become independently more powerful than almost any government alone. And there are, you know, there are other pockets of power. In particular, I've been reporting recently on the Middle East, the UAE and Saudi Arabia, which have, you know, currently it's a very expensive endeavor to push the frontiers of AI. It's, you know, in order to train larger and larger language models, you need a huge amount of compute, which is basically chips and infrastructure and power. And basically, almost no one has more of that than the UAE and Saudi Arabia at the moment. So you're actually seeing them attracting a lot of talent. They're investing in a lot of companies in Silicon Valley, but also, you know, our LPs, or kind of the investors into venture capitalists in California. So they're becoming sort of funding this entire surge of innovation we're seeing in AI, and they're also hoping that their citizens are going to benefit from it and are kind of integrating AI into their services much more rapidly than we're seeing in the West or anywhere else. So I think that will be another kind of nexus of power to watch.
Hello, Will Venters, academic at the LSE. I just wondered if we need a new language for error, because in computer science, error is where you've screwed up the code, and in engineering, it's where you've messed up something and it's broken. In statistics, it's a boundary, it's an expected condition that exists, and within AI, what we've done is taken that statistical boundary and industrialized it into active decision making, which has agency, and therefore error becomes industrialized. And I just wondered if a new language of error, which would be helpful here, and what that might be. But I don't know if you've got an answer.
OpenAI calls it temperature. Right?
Sorry? Hallucinations temperature. Is the best one. It's like an anthropomorphism.
Is the margin of error. That's what they call it. And hallucinations is the other word, which is essentially just fabrication and made up stuff. I try and never use hallucinations in my stories unless I then follow it up with, which is essentially complete fabrication of fact. But I think that's true. I think that we do need to, there has to be new language that emerges around the mistakes that come out of these systems. Because, you know, with Google search, we don't expect it to give us the wrong links or send us to the wrong answer, right? We have an expectation of truth and accuracy in that, whether that's correct or not. But with generative AI, as you say, it's built into the margin of how it behaves. It's a predictive system. It's likely to come up to predict something that isn't true. And I think the more we are habituated to that, the fact that it's not truth, it's not fact, it's not telling you the answer to a question, but instead it might help you to kind of brainstorm or come up with new ideas or kind of spark something, then we use it accordingly as well. But I think people still, we're still in that phase where people expect that it's telling you the truth, which I think is dangerous.
Well, the search engines have that little word underneath which says sponsored.
Which is becoming more and more widespread.
It's the first several pages of my search results every time. Very, very frequently. And Amazon as well. Just a big search engine. Okay, how about you in the back with holding your phone there? Yep. Yeah. Look, there you go.
Yes, thank you. I have a question about the role of natural languages in neural AI. We have seen cases which if we ask, let's say, ChatGPT a question in Chinese, but explicitly ask it to use sources in English, it will probably give you a different set of answers that, you know, without explicitly asking it to use sources in English. My question is because currently a lot of the sources which used by AI is in English online, would it risk entrenching the worldview of the English-speaking world around the world? And do we need some kind of a standardized working languages like the UN's official languages in when we build AI around the world? Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. This is something that I actually think about a lot. Because of the corpus of data that this is trained on is largely like the English-speaking internet. And of course, through language is how we embed our worldview, right? And so a lot of the English language internet does have a Western worldview, largely, and particularly, with the Chinese internet being, walled off in many ways. And so it is very much kind of Western views. There's a big question now about how do we teach AI systems to have ethics, and what ethics do we program into these systems, and how can we make this kind of globally relevant? But I think nobody has an answer to that yet. Like currently, I think Anthropic and OpenAI, they have something called a constitution, which is made up of things like Apple's terms and terms of service and the United Nations principles. So they've kind of brought together what they think are kind of representative of global ethics and created a constitution that their language models follow. But I don't think any of us would say that's like truly kind of representative of all of the cultures that I even talk about in my book, whether that's Argentina or India or Eastern Africa. So I think that's a huge, maybe it's an area of growth as well, as other countries kind of build their own language models. But for now, the biggest and most powerful ones are Western. I spoke to an interesting Harvard academic the other day, and we were talking about personal AIs, the kinds, people are using this a lot now as therapists or as relationship coaches, or even in some cases as friends to just talk to. And his concern was that increasingly the whole world starts to kind of move towards a very kind of Westernized view of relationships, even if you're going to start to use AI systems as friends or partners or mentors. And he was worried about how that might shape kind of younger generation of people. So I think, yeah, it's a kind of a really live issue.
We've got time for a couple more questions. How about you over here?
Thank you. My name is Alice. I work in consulting. So I wanted to go back to the human element a little. A key concern in AI is about the automating away jobs, whether partially or fully. And I know that jobs for most people is a very key part of their identity. When we stood up and introduced ourselves, we gave our names and our job titles. It defines our way of living, the types of social circles we have, the way we think. It's also a key indicator, not the only one, but of our contribution to society and how society values us. So going back to the question on the screen, what does it mean to be human in a world where our jobs no longer exist? Thank you.
Yeah, I think, the kind of first level of that question is, what happens if we all lose our jobs? And there's a fear element to that for sure. And I have, I reported about voice actors in particular, and I spent time with some of them. And, these are people which I didn't even realize, they voice background voices in Netflix shows, of course, adverts, audiobooks. And these are people who are trained to do this job. But you now have AI systems that can approximate, they're not as good as them. They don't have the range and the breadth that comes with being a trained voice actor. But they're cheap and kind of not too bad alternatives, and you're seeing already, I saw a tweet today, a woman had posted an email she got from the BBC, which said, hi, we've now received approval at the BBC to use AI-generated voices, so we will no longer need your services, Susie. And that was the end of the email. She was, she tweeted out saying, this is brutal. So I think there will, in the short term, we are going to kind of experience that, there will be short-term pain for sure when as we start to replace. And I think the next stage of that is, as you say, like who then are we and what do we do? And I think the answer, if I was a technologist building these systems, would be, wouldn't that be great? We'll just like all go hang out on the beach and read books and I don't know, make art, and we don't have to worry about going to work every day. But I'm not necessarily sure that that's what everybody wants. Like, there's different ways in which people are fulfilled, and you know. But I'm optimistic that work will change, but not necessarily kind of be completely obliterated. And my hope is that, you know, we will be able to do the things that we love about our jobs and use AI as a tool to assist us. But that can only be the case if we sort of manage the rollout of it in a way that doesn't just quickly replace people. But you know, I saw something somebody else mentioned today, that they had started to use AI in creative campaigns, for ad campaigns, and they were already starting to see that people were fatigued with AI generated campaigns, and they were able to tell the difference. They were tiring of it. So you know, my hope is that we can tell the difference, and we know what we value in a human authored book, or you know, a human written song or whatever, and that there's the market for that becomes the sort of, you know, like the kind of higher quality market on top of the sort of AI generated stuff.
I think we have time for one more question. I think we're going to go with this gentleman here in the middle.
I'm currently a sixth former, and I kind of aspire to be a journalist. And I'm wondering, kind of, because anytime I really say to people, oh, I want to become a journalist, they always tell me, oh, it's going to be hard due to AI. How do you think that AI affects journalism?
Yeah, it must be scary to try and come into something where you can already see how AI is changing it. I mean, I think I'm going to have to be really old school, because I've done this job now since 2012, so it's been 12 years I've been a journalist. And I think that there's always going to be places and publications that are going to value what you can do, which is be curious. Go out and find the stories that nobody is telling, and inform, entertain, and kind of delight people. And you know, I think no matter what, you know, what AI can do when it comes to kind of writing or kind of giving us information, there's always going to be room for human storytelling, in my view. I'm biased, being one of them already, but I would say that, like, we're never going to not want to hear stories told by other humans that we can relate to. So keep at it.
I think those are three excellent words to end on. Be curious, inform, entertain. I want to thank everyone for coming out in person, not doing or attending live online, because these are live human events with live human questions, not AI-generated questions. I want to thank you for coming here to the LSE this evening, and thank the online audience. Thank you to the online audience for watching. I would also mention that just a short plug for a couple of the upcoming events from the Data Science Institute. If you're interested in how AI and how the LSE is responding to the AI revolution, we are holding a two-day public symposium on AI and the knowledge economy in May. This is part of our collaboration with the Data Science Institute at Imperial College London. We call this DSI Squared. It's about how users, organizations, and policymakers can make generative AI a force for good. And that's exactly what we try to do through these events, and through the mission of our institute is to paraphrase the motto of the LSE, for the betterment of society. Our symposium will take place on the 20th and the 21st of May, and you can follow the DSI on social media for more details, which will be announced extremely soon. So the last thing I'll say is that you can purchase the book, which is for sale outside on the table. I strongly encourage you. It's a great read. You won't be disappointed. And afterwards, what we're going to do is, after you've purchased the book, you can come back in here, where Madhu will stay if you would like her to sign your copy of the book. We're not going to do it out in the atrium because it would become too crowded very quickly. So thank you all for coming, and I hope to see you again.
Thank you for listening. You can subscribe to the LSE Events podcast on your favorite podcast app and help other listeners discover us by leaving a review. Visit lse.ac.uk/events to find out what's on next. We hope you join us at another LSE event soon.